First, I really want to thank you for wrestling with masculine subjectivity and how necessary it is that we come to grips with it. And what I want to ask you about is you began by talking about the tension of the opposites, which I think is vitally important, that needs to be discussed. So given that, could you talk more about the deep feminine and the dark feminine that's part of your logic? And the reason why is not that it's this easy liberal, well, I want to accept women. It's more the fact that, for example, you argue that both men and women are wounded, and I believe that. But women's woundedness is structural in a way that man's woundedness is not. What do I mean by that? Right? In terms of the Western mindset, if we look at Adam and Eve, right, the whole notion that she is from his rib. So we don't have the Lilith story. We have the Eve story of a kind of acceptable femininity. And Mary Beard, who writes about women in power, discusses Homer's The Odyssey, which I love. But even that is based on, if we look at Telemachus, while his mother is fending off all these suitors, he tells her to shut up and to go back into her room. This is man stuff, right? So if you think about a book like Women Who Run With the Wolves, the feminine already has this quality, right, of a possibility. It's a fierce feminine, but in order for that to come out, it has to be connected to darkness. It has to be connected to power in ways that men just aren't used to accepting. So I understand what you mean by compassion, and I like what Dennis said about it. But if you look up the etymology of the word compassion, it begins with literally suffering with another, not suffering for another, suffering with. So if you could do some more talking about the feminine and how that, because I don't want to say one more thing. You're right. Make one more point. You're right about this. You're making me think about the emergence of the compassionate male. When in Ion, Jung argued that the new emerging paradigm would be the feminine. And the way he based that on rhizomatic thinking, not the thinking of a tree, but a rhizome, like you said, a nodal, a network. And I'll stop here. He ended his memory, dreams, and reflections with, if everything else goes away, all that remains is the rhizome, and the rhizome is a radical feminine. So that tension you're talking about, I think that's a good way to bring the deep feminine into it, because males can't be compassionate, in my view, unless we really wrestle with this notion of the deep feminine and women when they have power and how we respond to that and how I respond to that.
Yeah, and I'm not going to do it justice, the question, because it's a big question. But what occurs to me, it goes back to what Dana was talking about the lunar masculine, the solar masculine, the lunar feminine, the solar feminine. Dr. Karambu from Kenya, wonderful woman. You know, she said, you know, you men have got to work to embrace your divine feminine energy. And the women have got to work to embrace their divine male energy, masculine energy. That's and it's interesting because in my experience has been that I always hear about you guys got to go into your heart. And the guys think, oh, yeah, leave my head behind. I'm not going to do that. That's not what they're meaning. You know, let's integrate. But it's always about the man going into his heart. Where is it that you hear about the woman owning her solar? And I kind of think that's what you're getting at, that is a place. But when she steps up, you know, so oftentimes in the boardroom, and she steps up into that power, she's a bitch.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me. So let me make the question smaller.
Okay.
Thank you, Boris.
Please.
I thought it was small, but I'll re-ask it.
Okay.
If we're going to talk about the tension of the opposites in male compassion, then we need to talk about women in power and how they are structurally excluded.
Yeah.
Right. From certain kinds of behaviors. And let's stick with what you said about the bitch trope, right? Senator Ted Yoho or Hoho, whatever his name is, right, called Representative Alexandra Ortega Cortez, and forgive me if I got a middle name wrong, he called her a bitch. Why? Because she has power. She was not kowtowing to male acceptance, and he couldn't stand it. So he had to call her a bitch. Question, I think it's a question grounded in the everyday, actually.
Well, one of the things that I'm hoping that Selena can give us some perspective on, because what I know back in, I guess I was in my 20s, and there was a movie called Death Trap. Mm-hmm. And Christopher Reeve and Michael Caine, two of my heroes, were in this movie, and it was a murder mystery movie. And then Christopher Reeve was Superman. I mean, this was the height of what masculinity is, and here was Michael Caine, this debonair British. And I'm sitting in the movie theater, and they kiss. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. Here I was, even though my mother was in the theater and had gay friends and all, I had no idea that I would have this visceral reaction to this happening. So fast forward to today, we're getting an opportunity to see women in these power structures, and we're having these visceral reactions to it. I can tell you now that when I watch Glee and I watch the two male characters, I've forgotten their names, kiss, I can actually in my heart go, isn't that sweet? I could not have done that before. It has taken a while for me to grow emotionally, to be able to grow enough to be able to do, to have those kinds of reactions. Do you think so, Selena? Do you see a growth process happening?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. And I think what you're saying, Dennis, is it is a process. And I think it's a shock initially because we our family set us in certain patterns, and then we follow that. And if anything goes out of the patternage and we don't have a way for it, we are shocked. But because of the intensity of all the different forms of streaming, television, Facebook, TikTok, we are hit at such a level right now that we've never been in the history of the world. So where this is going to go, I don't know. But we are called right now to process things at a very different frequency or vibration than we ever have.
How do you see that, Selena? I love that because to me, we're getting now into practical applications. Forgive me, I'm just practical. Why talk about the compassionate male? Except for our own healing, who cares? So when you talk about, Selena, where we are and sort of I hear the need for this, please speak more to that, because I'm feeling that as well, but I'd like to see how you see that playing out.
I'm not sure the question that you're asking.
The need for I think this different way of being in the world and experiencing the world. I think we're all feeling like whatever we're doing now isn't going to carry the freight for much longer. So where do you, from your perspective as a therapist, see movement?
Movement for men is going to be very different, of course, than movement for women. I think, and I'm going to agree with the direction that you, Clay, and Dennis are going, it is heart-centered. It is all about the heart. It is opening up the heart chakra. And I think that, and acceptance, that is the key. And compassion is absolutely part of that. I think the heart opening is the key. It's the key for love. I think love is in a healing archetype that transcends everything. So I'm looking at that from that perspective, heart, chakra, compassion, to really embrace that in each life, whether it's men or women. But for the men, compassion, heart opening leads to transformation. And the heart opening can be through a relationship. It can be through kindness. It can be through mentoring. I mean, however the heart has to open, it doesn't matter the way. It matters that it opens and that you have to do something different than you normally do. Because if you're doing the same thing over and over, you're not going to get to it. You've got to step out of yourself and go to a different aspect of yourself. Otherwise, change will not occur.
I just had a thought, and you know, we're talking, Dennis and I, you know, the new compassionate male. What put me on that path was when I went to the Parliament of the World's Religions in the fall of 2018. And I was visiting with the board chair for the Charter for Compassion. And I said, look here, there literally are 10,000 people up here, 10,000 from all these religious traditions all over the world. Hundreds of sessions that are going on. And I looked through the book and looked through all the sessions. And I said, you know, Charlie, there's not one session on men. You know, and then I said, the Charter for Compassion has got these 12 initiatives. And the last one is women and girls. Where's the initiative for men? Now, we're the elephant in the room. I mean, face it, okay? And so that's where I have really narrowed and said, okay, let's work on the men and compassion element, because the rest of the world are working with, you know, all the rest of it. But we men have got to get our stuff together. You know, I'm going to step out with a generality. From my experience, I believe what I've seen is women being a bit more conscious than men. And so for us to be on equal footing, let's bring the woman down. That's not going to work. We guys have got to come up like this. And that's work men have got to do with men. And it's not running naked in the woods. It's in a caring, nurturing environment, safe environment, so that we can begin to work and find that language and practice that in a circle without judgment and recognize that we guys are on the same plane so much. I mean, with variation, but that's so systemic. And so that we can become more conscious, so that we can come together on equal level. So my view in looking at and trying to describe or embrace the overall picture, I haven't tried to do that. I've tried to stay, let's get the men thing worked out, because we're the elephant in the room.
May I make one short observation, because I know we want to get the audience in and I want to be brief. But just to finish, and David, to respond to you with the practical, which I also feel an impulse towards, what we have said, if I'm remembering Jung correctly, what we have said about holding the tension of opposites is absolutely true. But Marion Woodman, just a superb Jungian analyst, said, yes, we have the capacity to hold the tension of opposites. And she'd always have her hands up and a little space between them. And we hold the tension, and we hold the tension until a third thing emerges, which Jung called the tertium quid, the third thing. So I just wanted to add that to this rich metaphor, because there's a tremendous practicality in learning the patience and endurance to hold that tension. And then I think it's an act of faith that some third thing will emerge that is what Jung called the transcendent function. And it's a marriage between the two sides of the tension. And it's the birth of the new.
It does seem to me that
we are faced with the call for new mythologies, that we have to come up with new paradigms, not necessarily uncover new archetypes, because the archetypes have always been there. But, you know, as Campbell said, this is a time to create new mythologies, and maybe your compassionate male is one of those. And I might suggest that, you know, a big part of that is being vulnerable, being humble, being accessible, showing ourselves to be open to new solutions, new ways of being, and not always needing to govern ourselves by goals and outcomes and profit and all of the kinds of things that typically define a material, consumer-based kind of identity and reality. You know, one of the things that I want to play off on is what Dennis Tardin mentioned in the very beginning of his comments about our being interconnected. Humanity as a species and we as individuals are born into the world interconnected. We're deeply implicated in the ways and beings of one another. In fact, when a child is born, it is inseparable from the mother, and it's not until they actually become separated that the whole idea of individual self starts to take form. And the problem with this is that that is the start of patriarchy. That's the start of where this whole issue of control starts to come in, both at a cultural and individual level. And we have to contrive ways of being that kind of allow patriarchy its place. What tends to happen is that we go with our left brain and we start thinking about stuff and we start reasoning and we start developing that capacity for interpretation and name giving and symbol making and all of the things that put the world into its rational frames of reference. We just finished a project with David Bohm called The Infinite Potential. And the physicists are now coming up with the whole reality of understanding oneness from actually a scientific standpoint. And what we're finding is that the oneness that we left at the very beginning is now the oneness to which we're returning. So we're going through this whole odyssey, and the one healing element may be compassion. As we move from oneness at the beginning to oneness at the end, what we really have is the ability to be compassionate, to nurture those interconnections that we feel with one another. And we can feel it in our relational capacities. And whether you're masculine or feminine, or you're a male or a female, when we're in a relationship, that relationship is that third thing. That's the thing that we begin to nurture. And the compassion is what keeps it alive. Here's Howard. Now, Howard approached me about a little over a year ago to help write a project about the lunar masculine and the solar feminine. And I had not really heard those words at that time. And I really started working with it, and I found that both of the archetypes, whether they're solar or lunar, have paired opposites. Howard calls them tunas. And tunas was something that it goes way back in terms of philosophy and religious studies and what have you. But maybe we could let Howard talk. Howard, can we hear you? I hear your voice.
Thank you. Yeah, this is such a surprisingly powerful seminar for me, having been very trained in Jungian archetypal psychology and feeling stuck in the definition of the anima, and having to actually follow Joseph Campbell's earliest thing he wrote in 1943, the twin hero mythology, the Navajo twin hero mythology. And to my shock, I found that every pre-Judeo-Christian culture had twin males in their architecture and labeled that by the cultures, not Cain and Abel, not brothers, but twins. And through a deep search that I went through to figure this out for my own sanity, I came across the Mayan myth of the twins who face the ball court and they win, and they're making too much noise for the lords of the underworld. So they go down there and they actually defeat them. And, but they realize they're mortal, so they have to jump into a fire. And one is born as the sun and one is born as the moon. And that was my wake-up call to all these different twin male mythologies, pre-Judeo-Christian culture, because it was Romulus who kills the twin Remus. And so that what you get is this distorted architecture of the masculine. And so I've written about this and done a bunch of stuff on it. And where I had to get past was, this is going to be controversial, the feminine side of men, and seeing if you really got to the quantum physics label of reflective consciousness, reflection or the wave, and you got to the particle, you got beyond gender. And that was the real wake-up call for me to develop another part of my masculinity, which for me was actually the solar male. And that was what was more wounded in me than the lunar male, which was very internal. But on and on and on I could go. So where I had to really liberate myself from is the, you know, Jung's definition of the masculine, which is the anima, the way he defines it. I know there's a bunch of new work being done. But to really operate at this at the quantum level of wave and particle and see what men and women with the consciousness that this group and other groups have, I think is a revolution to look for two-ness rather than oneness and hierarchy where they're actually entangled at the level of, at the quantum level until they emerge. And it's when they emerge to be able to have the reflective consciousness to combine it with its complement, not its opposite only.
Nice, Howard.
I'm so interested in this particle wave conversation, and it brings in one of the really important things. We've heard a couple people use the word individualism. You know, it is one of the things we typically can associate with patriarchy or hypermasculinity is hyper-individualism. And, you know, whether or not that's true, that's one of the ways, one of the things that comes up. And the atom, the particle, is hyper-individualized. And so if you build your whole worldview around an atomistic worldview, then you're going to project that back at yourself. All of our values are going to be based on atomism. Memes, it's just another translation of atomism. You know, so atomism, when our cultural values are built on a paradigm of everything being individual, of course, we're all going to be individualistic. And, you know, when you integrate the wave, you're integrating something that has a different metaphor. The wave is the elixir, is the feminine when we drink it in the holy, in the form of the Holy Grail, is what's being imbibed and integrated. And the elixir, the wave, we've talked about this, Howard, water, you know, or sound waves, we all play different musical instruments than a single microphone can record that is a single wave. If we all throw our sand in the middle of the room, it will not converge, it will not combine. Things cannot do that. Atoms cannot do that. But waves absolutely can have no problem with oneness and manyness. And so when you end up with the particle wave duality, you end up with a paradoxical duality between something that's totally individual and something that's totally everything, you know, indivisible, capable of being one in many. I don't know. I want to appreciate Howard bringing in those paradigms, those concepts to this conversation.
Here's a question, Clay and Dennis, in your experience, and it goes, I think, to what you're a little bit you're talking about, the subatomic level, Will, but going back to the tension, how do we as males, if we're talking about a compassionate male paradigm, I think one of the fears that I have in my gut is compassion is weak, vulnerability is weak, openness is weak. And in my heart, that feels good, but I live in a world surrounded by other people who will pounce on that weakness, either in a workspace or a relationship or now in the culture that we're in. So how, from your experience and the work you're doing with men, how do we have this, what I would call strong compassion or deep masculine male? It's a strength, not a weakness.
What I go back to my time in the Marine Corps, there was nothing weak about us. Not a damn thing. We were the toughest. And we were compassionate. So I would, at the time wearing my Marine Corps uniform, I'd defy anybody to call me weak. And they could call me compassionate, but not weak. So that's kind of a frame of reference that I've got. I know that that's not the typical, because I agree, it's compassion is weak. You know, somebody said on our podcast the other day, I grew up thinking that compassion was petting puppy dogs. Remember that, Dennis?
Yeah, I sure do. And the, one of the things, David, is that what I found is, what is the value of the assist? Like Wayne Gretzky, the greatest scorer in the history of hockey, also had the greatest number of assists. How do you make, what do you get the value of making some other person great? Some other team great? What is the value in you doing that? And when we dig into there, compassion comes out, because it comes for both the greater good, the good of the organization, but the person gets the joy of nurturing and seeing another person grow and get stronger, another team, another issue, another value grow and get stronger. And it gives them the opportunity to be able to see that as a value add as opposed to a weakness.
If I can jump in, I wanted to reconnect back with the point that Voris raised earlier in regards to the greater myths that we have. And he was talking about how, in the story of creation or in the Garden of Eden, Eve is created from Adam's rib and, she's held responsible for the whole thing. Now, when you come to the Quranic version of that, there is no Eve. There's just Adam, and Adam is androgynous. And when the forbidden fruit is consumed, the dialogue with the God is answered in a dual form in the Arabic language, that the two of us did it unto ourselves, and they ask for forgiveness. And in a way, you would look at that in the process of the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, that this was a revision, a reform, a changing the whole narrative, trying to get this whole narrative, the myth, get rid of the feminine being victimized and all that. Well, that all sounds wonderful. But in the matter of a few decades, when a whole lot of Christians and Jews converted into Islam, the dominant Islamic cultural narrative today is not a Quranic narrative. It is a Judeo-Christian narrative. The name of Eve has entered back into the dialogue. They name their children Eve, and all the rest of the story, everything is in there. The reason I'm mentioning this is that, yes, let's imagine that Prophet Muhammad and the Quran came as a reform to make the changes that were necessary to stop the victimization of the feminine and all that. Yes, but then this misogynist mindset very stubbornly comes back and take the center stage. And now when you go to, most of the Islamic culture, 98.3221% of them are all thinking same as along the Judeo-Christian tradition. And you would say that, okay, why are they so misogynistic if the Quran is speaking that way? And I'm saying that, yes, but they are not Quranic Muslims. At least in this regard, the Muslims of today are more Judeo-Christian than they are Muslims when it comes to these values. So my concern is that, yes, we can have reforms, such reforms that could be divine as the Quran is perceived, And yet the society will stubbornly hang on to the value system that was there. And it would seem like if nothing had happened.
I think you're right about that, and I appreciate that intervention. Where I'm having some resistance is that oftentimes the practical hides the status quo. And if to talk about these issues, to not talk about power, is very much a problem, one. And let's go back to Wells' intervention around the particle. What's interesting about that observation, right, is Will knows whether it's a particle or a wave depends upon observation, the instrument that's being observed, et cetera, et cetera. And when you're making comments like what the heart will do and that things are getting better, then to ask the rhetorical question, for whom? Who believes that? Who thinks that? And I can give you a list of folks who don't think things are getting better. Right? In this country, things are getting worse for the poor. It's getting worse for the middle class. So I understand the importance of individuation. That's why I'm in this with this group. But the practical, and to not talk about power, is something that needs to be addressed. Not here, and as you said, it's larger, but how can you not talk about it when you're talking about individuation and liberation?
Hear, hear.
And it's so amazing the way that what was the big thing in a lot of these dystopian novels is that we internalize the power and we give it a voice inside of ourselves. So even if we're talking about the psyche, you know, we still need to talk about the power out there because we're likely to be internalizing it as our own set of voices.
Well, and here's my bias sometimes around compassion. And I'm not saying that it applies to anybody here, but it can be a cop out from action. And one of the things I think that happens to it, so this would be an indictment against those of us who are privileged, who have the time to contemplate our navels, is while we're doing our own inner work, we might remove ourselves from a world that needs us to be engaged. And not all engagement is compassion. I mean, the people in the streets this summer are angry. That's not compassion. It's rage and it's hurt. And that's action. And I was, a friend of mine is an attorney, and he was sharing with his daughter a conversation we were having because she's 14 and she's feeling the empathy with folks who are demonstrating and the power differential you're talking about, Boris, which is great about teenage kids because they feel it like right now. And what I shared with him and he shared with her, because it was an insight for him, because he's an attorney. He wants process. He wants to involve the heart and the head. We all get together and come to good outcome. But these demonstrations in the streets were rubbing him a wrong way. It made him uncomfortable. And I said, well, brother, I said, what often has to happen out for change to happen is that angry people have to get angry and be pissed off.
So first, you got to get mad, network, right?
Yeah, then the rest of us wake up. So yes, the power. And so how, if we're talking about being a compassionate male, that goes back for me, and I apologize if I'm dominating this, but I go back to the practical.
Could I?
Yeah.
Yeah, so where I connect with that was back with these young Kenyans. You know, yes, you have the sword in one hand, but you also have the hand of compassion. It's not an either or. It's a yes and. And to be able to hold and have the discernment and the judgment to show up as a complete male, fully integrated, I didn't put down the sword.
So you use the sword if necessary.
Well, in fact, the hero only gets to claim the sword after, when done properly, after that ego death has occurred first. That to suffer with compassion, to suffer with, you can't be a hero unless it's with and for, you know, it's got to be with and for, you know, and so you only get to get that special sword. The bow should only fall off easily for you if that's where you are.
Well, and you know, for me, I think of empathy as to sit with someone, and compassion is, yes, to sit with someone and take action. to take action. And the people that are in rage are showing compassion to me, from my vantage point, through their rage for their...
The people who are marching and protesting and doing what they're doing as an example of showing compassion are having compassion for the people that they are a part of who aren't there. You know, there are a lot of people, when I look at these, they're not demonstrations. They're real. They've put their lives in action. They've pushed from the side of the pool out into the middle of the fray, and it's a place where they can get hurt. But they have to risk and trust that this is actually something that reflects the true sense and nature of their being. That means that they're tied to the people back home, their friends, the community they're a part of, and putting themselves often at great risk to do that.
They're laying down their life for their friend.
For their friend.
Or maybe they're willing to die for their kids.
Same thing. I mean, same.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that you bring up practicality, David. I'm not against pragmatism. I'm just arguing that it's cultural. I have a good friend who's Kenyan. And he tells me all the time that I'm too busy trying to help people. And sometimes the way you help them is by allowing them to suffer so they can individuate. And I think from his perspective, makes a good point. So I just wanted to add that I think I'm struggling with the practical, but I also want to understand that our observations come from particular perspectives, and we have to take that into account if we really want to be compassionate.
You know, Karambu, she's in Meru, Kenya, and that's who hosted me out there last year. And she said, I don't want your money. I don't want that help. You know, that's colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to help me, come over here. Let's work together. Let's go work together. And that really helped me out. Helped put things into perspective. So I agree, Morris.
I think this might be a really appropriate place to bring our Myth Salon today, you know, to a conclusion.
Socrates never comes to a conclusion at the end of any of his dialogues. This topic is gargantuan. Are we talking about, you know, the masculine? Are we talking about the feminine? Are we talking about inequality in the world between men and women? You can't talk about it all in 2 hours, and I appreciate your focus on the masculine and the integration of what the masculine needs to add in. But so I just want to say, just a quick note to say, obviously this topic is way bigger than we can ever cover. And, you know, it's an honor just to talk about it, knowing we probably aren't going to come to any more conclusions than a Socratic dialogue.